From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, America celebrates Memorial Day. It's a day that comes with ready-made Norman Rockwell images, parades, speeches, flags, neighborhood barbecues. But this year, again, real war and fear and sacrifice are in the picture. U.S. troops are still in Iraq, and the graves of war dead are fresh. Terrorists continue to strike. Americans will travel and barbecue today on Code Orange Alert. A day of respectful remembrance is colored with pride and tinged with fear of what may still be to come. And with that, hard questions about America's evolving role as a world power and a military power, about patriotism, about duty, about dissent. In this Memorial Day edition of On Point, we will hear from Americans who served in Operation Iraqi Freedom and from others. A chaplain, a soldier's mother, and veterans of the First Gulf War will all speak about a world after Iraq and the meaning of Memorial Day in a volatile 21st century. And with us throughout the hour with his thoughts and comments, we'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
We begin tonight with Major John Brownfield, who fought with the Connecticut Air National Guard 103 Fighter Wing in western Iraq. He returned from duty on May 1st. We spoke as he prepared a speech for today's Memorial Day parade in East Granby, Connecticut. Major John Brownfield, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
I understand that you are the Memorial Day speaker in East Granby, Connecticut. What's the heart of your message there, Major?
Well, it's Memorial Day, and that began in the Civil War, and ever since has been a Men of the Day remembrance for the men and women in the armed services who've given the ultimate sacrifice so that we today enjoy the freedoms that we do. And it'll be a message pretty much along those lines, with maybe a little added flavor of the most recent conflict of which I was a part to maybe add a sense of relevance.
What kind of detail do you think you may share from your time in Iraq that may bring this Memorial Day speech right up to date, 2003?
Well, as an overarching theme, I was contemplating just taking one or two experiences that I had down there, witnessing not so much the bravery on our part as pilots, but being made aware of the incredible bravery some of the guys on the ground that we were directly supporting and the danger in which they put themselves, because although it looked like a pretty easy war from the perspective back home, I can tell you that there were moments over there when our guys on the ground were facing some pretty insurmountable odds in terms of overwhelming numbers of opposing forces versus the small number of guys we had trying to accomplish their mission.
Major Brownfield, could you share one of those stories with us?
Well, there was a battle for a dam that was damming up a rather large body of water there along the Euphrates River, which was a key crossing point for some of our armored forces to get around to the north side of Baghdad. And initially they had thought that they needed to hold that dam for a very short amount of time to get some forces across. And in the process of crossing the dam, they found that it was wired for demolition. And, you know, the obvious implications of that, they were directed, this rather small force, to hold the dam, not just for a short time, but to hold it for an extended period of time. And they were woefully under strength for that kind of mission because it was a heavily defended site, one of the few. And they got into a week-long, intense firefight.
A week-long?
It was a week-long battle that was fairly continuous. And these guys, almost round the clock for about a week, trying to hold off the Iraqis.
And what were you flying, and where were the U.S. soldiers who were at the dam? Were they on the dam or around it, and how
were
you supporting them?
They were on the dam. They made themselves a very obvious target, and they were just incredibly brave. And we were able to support them, and you know, a few of them got killed, but they were able to hold the dam long enough.
And were you in fixed wing or helicopter?
Fixed wing. I fly A-10s with Connecticut Air National Guard.
Is that what they call the Warthog?
That's the Warthog, yes.
So this is a lot of firepower that can be brought from the air.
Yes, that's true. But we weren't the only ones. There were F-16s supporting it as well. I mean, there were many different aircraft brought to bear to provide air support to these guys.
So you plan to bring your obvious inspiration from those soldiers at the dam back to share with the folks in East Granby?
I haven't given a complete thought to it, but that was, I thought, the most obvious and outstanding displays of bravery and pure down guts that springs to mind right away when I think about my various experiences over there.
Major Brownfield, when you went to war in Iraq and watched others fighting there as well, when you stand up to speak on this Memorial Day, do you feel American soldiers today are in a direct line of kind of descent from
Civil War soldiers that you mentioned earlier, the soldiers in World War I, World War II, or has war changed in its technology and in its execution in such a way that it's a different thing now, that soldiers are engaged in a different kind of activity?
Well, it certainly has become more complex. The old way of doing it, where we did not maintain a standing army, really, it was fairly quick and not too complicated to raise an army, train them adequately to where they were useful as a force, and that's no longer the case. There's so much interoperability between the various services, the technology has gotten much more complex, that if you're going to go from a standstill of having no army to having one that's big enough and competent enough to actually be effective is a number of years. And I think that was shown to be the case already by World War II, and is one of the reasons it took us almost 4 years from the time that we entered the war to the time where we were able to actually mount an invasion of mainland Europe.
But I wonder if you think it's different memorializing a citizen army and the more highly trained, nearly professional military that we have today.
Oh, no. I mean, qualitatively, I think it's the same. The motivations are the same. What we're fighting for really is the same. It's still freedom. It's still fighting for our way of life. It seemed less so to me until recently. I knew we were protecting our national interests, which is something, but after September 11th and being attacked on our home soil, it definitely feels much more like I'm directly contributing to the defense of our freedom and our way of life here at home. It has much more of an immediate impact to me now than it did 2 or 3 years ago.
And when you stand up before that gathering in East Granby on Memorial Day, do you expect to look out on a crowd of fellow Americans who look upon the U.S. military in the way they did, in 1975, in 1955, in 1865? Or does the public view of the military seem different in your mind?
I think probably the public view of the military is more positive today than it was 20 years ago. 50 years ago, I think it was probably fairly comparable to the way it is today. I anticipate that it'll be a positive reception, although I don't know. There could be protesters there. There are always those who disagree. And to be honest with you, it's the first time I've ever spoken to any public gathering, so I don't know what quite to expect. I guess I'll just have to deal with it as it comes.
Major Brownfield, good luck in East Granby, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Major John Brownfield fought with the Connecticut Air National Guard, 103rd Fighter Wing in Iraq. Today he spoke at the Memorial Day Parade in East Granby, Connecticut. Jack Beatty, there's one little vignette from Iraq. American soldiers deep in Iraq holding a dam on the Euphrates. Stories we had not heard from a straight-ahead soldier.
Yes, the idea of fighting for a week, we had heard nothing of that. And it just makes me think that perhaps a lot of these stories were missed. This was a war between a country that spent $1 billion a year on defense and one that spent $400 billion. Nevertheless, it required courage and fortitude, and I think some of these stories evoke that.
There's a story right there. Next, Jack, we turn to a veteran who served in the first Gulf War and came home to write about it. Joel Turnipseed was on the front lines in Iraq with the Marines and wrote about his experience in a powerful first-hand account, Baghdad Express, a Gulf War memoir. Joel Turnipseed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Joel, we talked with you earlier in the war. We talked with you at the height of the war. Now here we are. War is essentially over, and we're coming up on another Memorial Day. This is a day for remembrance, for reflection, for honoring soldiers and fallen soldiers. I wonder what's going through your mind as we come up on this Memorial Day.
The first thing that comes to mind is this was the time of year, of course, that I returned from the last Gulf War, and I will always remember my first steps back onto campus thinking, man, I've just returned from a place where I was always dressed in full body armor, gas mask, and walked around with a K-bar and a M16. And boy, if I stepped on campus that way, I'd be arrested immediately. And that's when I sort of knew that my life had sort of forever changed in some way.
You're back in a realm of peace where all the accoutrements of war were out. They were distant suddenly.
Yeah, there's such a sharp divide between the life of where stealing and killing is your day job and being a philosophy student or programmer or whatever it is that you do during your day life.
Joel, you were there in the Gulf War. You came home from that war. You, like all of us, watched this war. How, to your mind, should the country be observing this Memorial Day?
To me, on all these sort of succeeding Memorial Days, I always think sort of first of the guys that were with me on the Baghdad Express, our little ragtag band of tractor trailers and reservist drivers. And we had three guys die. And things had gotten sort of so desperate by the end of our war that we started calling our camp, not one more life. I think we should probably try to remember that for all of its sort of patriotism, to remember that it's also sort of patriotic gore, as the phrase of Edmund Wilson, and that it's something to be taken with a deep air of sort of somberness.
You know, Memorial Day still has a lot of the trappings from big 20th century wars, the kind of World War II trappings. I associate it, I think many people do, with older veterans, with their World War II caps, the kind of rows of flags, the trumpeter. For a younger generation of soldiers, are those the trappings that bespeak honor, that bespeak remembering war, your war, in a way that speaks to you, Joel Turnipseed?
It's funny, you know, I was thinking about it as Memorial Day was approaching, and the thing that I always associate with Memorial Day and spring in general are the Midwest's tornado sirens, which sounded just like our scud alarms. You know, I remember running naked in the middle of the night with nothing but, you know, boxer shorts and dog tags, and I remember eventually learning to sort of ignore those sirens, and then there was that final chastening night when that scud killed 28 reservists and injured 100 more, making, you know, water purification specialists the most dangerous occupation of the war. Mm. So I think, to me, the trappings are not of grand battles, but of sort of small moments of both scrambling and even of death, and it just doesn't seem as sort of heroic. It seems more like a waste.
So if Americans far from war want to speak to or think of veterans of these Gulf Wars in a way that's meaningful, how do you suggest they do it?
You know, the best way is to ask young guys to tell their stories in a way that doesn't put them in the position of having to make it seem like it was super cool. A lot of the rhetoric of war and even a little bit of the coverage was that it was high tech and spit polished and brass balled and super cool. Mm. That's not how most of the guys that I talk to feel about it. You know, on this Memorial Day, I'll be both in Iowa City and then New York over the weekend telling my stories. And the stories we told each other late at night in the tent were sort of about the ambiguity of the Marine Corps motto, Semper Fidelis. You know, what are we being faithful to? Is it the shame or the honor? You know, is it the despair or the pride or the anger at the stupid waste or the hope that maybe this will be the last time we have to go fight a war? And so I think actually just listening to what these 22-year-old kids or 35-year-old guys, you know, I know some of the guys I served with in the last one are over there again as their wives and families have called me and said to wish them well. And so, in fact, they're still over there. And so, you know, really to just listen to the guys' stories and let them tell it and not expect it to either be a rousing adventure or flag-waving homily to the greatness of America.
Joel, have you walked in Memorial Day parades? Have you put on your military uniform and gone back out in the street?
I have to confess that seems like it's the corniest thing in the world to me, and maybe it's just because I'm still fairly young at 35. But I did join the VFW, of all things, a couple of years ago at the Minnesota State Fair, and I've never stepped foot in a hall, but it's just one of those things where, yeah, you know, it's very hard, as you said earlier, for me as still a relatively young man to think of VFW. I associate with 70-year-old men playing bingo, and so maybe, you know, as I get older, that will change for me. But I think partly also a temper of and a reflection on what happened in Vietnam, you know, when we learned to sort of take the idea of celebrating war in a much different tone than I think the general population took at the time when joining the VFW was sort of the thing to do in the neighborhood.
So, Joel, let us take your cue. Let us not be grand, but remember one soldier who you knew in the Gulf War who died.
Yeah, that's a guy named Daniel Joel, you know, from our unit, died in a horrible truck accident, and so did several other guys in our unit. And so I think that name of our camp, Camp Not One More Life, is one of those ones that we should all think about is, you know, we should only ever sacrifice these lives because that's what we're doing.
What was he like, this truck driver?
Basically a quiet guy who, you know, loved to drive his car and hang out and, you know, was sort of one of the happy-go-lucky guys in our unit. And, you know, a lot of times those are the guys that die. It's the somber, quiet guy maybe doesn't take the risks that he needs to get his job done as well as he can. And there's always that guy that's spit-polished and bulletproof. And those crusty guys never seem to die. It's just the guy on the block who's a super nice guy who likes to play around and have fun who one day is no longer with you.
He's at war, and then he's gone. Joel Turnipseed, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Joel Turnipseed is a veteran of the First Gulf War and author of Baghdad Express, a Gulf War memoir. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Jack Beattie and a special Memorial Day edition of On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking on this Memorial Day with active duty American military, veterans, and their families about their experience of war and the meaning of a day of remembrance. Army Sergeant First Class Luis Diaz is with a mobile exploration team that was searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He returned from the Gulf a week ago. He spoke with me from Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Sergeant Luis Diaz, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You will have been home just about a week on Memorial Day. What were you doing in Iraq?
Actually, I was working with the 75th Mobile Exploration Team, and our main duty was to go out and find weapons of mass destruction or evidence of that.
Wow, really interesting task. As far as we know from the headlines and news reports we've read, we haven't found WMD yet. Where were you looking, and how did you feel about, I guess, coming up pretty much empty-handed?
Well, actually, we haven't actually found what they call the smoking gun. There's possibilities that there was traces that it could have been there, but a lot of it could have been destroyed. We don't really know yet, but what we're doing is dealing with people, talking to them. As you've seen in the news, there was a couple of mobile labs that came up.
Yes.
There continues to investigate those at this time right now.
How long were you in theater, in the Iraq area, for the war, Sergeant Diaz?
I was there approximately about 4 months.
And had you been specifically trained for this pursuit of weapons of mass destruction?
Yes, I've been in the chemical field for about 17 years now, and I've been with a technical escort unit for the last three. And this is actually my second trip to Iraq. I used to be a UN inspector also.
Were you there for the first Gulf War?
I was actually in Egypt, so I saw it from a little distance working on a different mission.
Sergeant Diaz, what was your sense of the war this time? Did you have the sense that you were there on a worthy mission? And watching from up close, how did you think about how the war went?
Well, I think it went pretty good. Everybody was looking for the WMD aspect of it, but I believe one of the great things that we did was actually free the country so the country can actually be in a democratic way. The people there nowadays, they were thankful that we're there. They're free. They're able to pursue something different in life besides, you know, whatever Saddam had for them. So I think we actually did a great job for them. And once when all the countries get together and help rebuild the place, it'll be a really nice country.
Your family, as I understand, has been involved with the military for more than one generation. And right now you and your wife are both in. Can you give us a little history there?
My dad spent 23 years in. About four of my uncles have been in the military. My wife, she was active duty for about 13 years, and then now she's in the National Guard, and she's got about total about 19 years in. Her brother was actually in Vietnam, so we have a little military history. Last year, my wife was deployed to Bosnia for 7 months, and then this year I was deployed to Iraq, so we kind of play tag team at this.
I guess. You know, of course, deployments of U.S. military have increased in the last decade or so, partly peacekeeping, partly war. What's your sense, Sergeant Diaz, about how the U.S. military is being used today? Are we asking soldiers to do too much? Are we deploying too often? Or is this the right use of the United States Armed Forces?
I think we're being used pretty well. When you do go to the country and you see what the people are going through, and by helping them and then talking to my wife when she was in Bosnia, you know, they encouraged them. They liked the Americans there and the other coalition teams there because they were actually helping them rebuild. And same thing with Iraq. The people were just trying to make a living, and under Saddam's regime, they weren't able to do that. And a lot of people who were poor went without. But I think we're actually doing a pretty good job, and once we get them on their feet, they'll be able to run their own country.
Can you describe some of your interactions with Iraqis while you were in the country, Sergeant Diaz? What was that like?
The people were very open to us. They were very interested in who we were, and it was kind of funny at times because their aspect of a person from America, they couldn't realize that we had so many different cultures in America itself. And I'm from California with a Hispanic background.
Mm-hmm.
They thought I was Arabic because of brown skin, dark hair.
Just visually, they'd look at you
right.
And think, ah, he's one of us.
Right, and it comes out knowing that I speak very little Arabic, and I tell them, you know, I'm from Mexico again.
Right.
They were very interested in us as far as the U.S., and they always wanted to know, like, about family and, you know, do you miss your family and, you know, how long do you want to stay here? And we try to talk to them, like, soon you'll be running the country and I'll be back with my family. And they were very open-hearted to us, the people.
And when you said that, did they believe you that soon they would be running their country?
The majority of them did. It's the older people that are really kind of concerned because they're so used for the last 38 years have been under Saddam's hand. And they're still nervous. And I was telling them, I said, your children are the ones that are going to have to run this country. And I think those kids, they were so happy that Saddam was not in power anymore. They're able to look at life, and we tell them that soon you're going to be working, and you're going to be working in this country, taking care of it. And they seem excited about it.
Sergeant Diaz, the Army, the government gives you a paycheck, but from your fellow citizens on Memorial Day, what else would you like?
On Memorial Day, you know, we all get together. This Memorial Day, we're actually going down to the Women's Memorial. They're doing a dedication for a new Women's Memorial for Native Americans. My wife is a Native American also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're going to spend. And I just like it when people come up and say thank you. That is the most you can get from anything, when they say thank you. And I've seen the protesters in Washington, D.C., and their protest against the war. And I look at it this way. I said, you're welcome. And they look at me, and it's like, what do you mean? I says, well, if we didn't fight for your freedom, you would not be able to protest. So I say, you know, do your protest, but you're welcome, because we let it you to be free so you can do this. But when people just say thank you, that makes you feel great.
Sergeant Luis Diaz, thank you very much for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you much.
Sergeant First Class Luis Diaz is with the Army's 75th Field Artillery Brigade. He returned home from Iraq just last Monday. He spoke with me from Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Jack Beatty, all he wants is a thank you, but there's a big story there.
There is a big story there, and he hopes that it'll be a really nice country. And I think that's something that will justify this war for many people, if this experiment in reconstituting Iraq and in making it a really nice country works.
Jack, let's listen next to an interview I did with Brian Murphy. He's a veteran of the first Gulf War, where he served in the 124th Intelligence Battalion as an Arab language specialist and as direct support for the 24th Infantry Division in Iraq. The American military today is being deployed longer and in greater numbers. I asked Brian Murphy if that leaves Memorial Day meaning something different for him.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not sure that the old understanding of Memorial Day, at least the way I remember it, applies to today. I mean, Memorial Day is kind of an idea that we as a nation are prepared to make sacrifices for noble purposes. And I saw no such noble purpose in this last military engagement.
There was a lot of language of nobility around it, language of saving the world from tyranny, turning back terror, about being prepared to sacrifice in the name of freedom.
Sure. Those are great words, and I think that's to be expected. You know, how else do you get young men and women to participate in something like that? And it helps for servicemen. I mean, people like to tell themselves the most palatable, kind of attractive stories about their own circumstances anyway. You know, I remember coming back from the first Gulf War, and, you know, it was really amazing, the reception that we got. And, hey, that was great. But as the years have passed, my memories of that event are very strange. I just remember the absurdity of it all.
You know, why absurdity?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, one of the interesting things about the military is that you're exposed to such a wide cross-section of the U.S. population, with maybe the exception of class and economic circumstances. Mm. So here's this
ethnically and racially.
Right, exactly, and geographically. Mm-hmm. So here are all these, like, regular people out in this surreal landscape, caught up in this weird theater of destruction. And you realize that your opponents are just these tired, hungry, terrified Iraqi conscripts. It's kind of hard to reconcile that with the marching bands and the mythic sense of war that the government would like everybody to feel and remember.
Brian Murphy, you fought in that first Gulf War. You protested against the latest war with Iraq. Was it your experience in Iraq that turned you around, or what?
Not necessarily. Maybe it's just a matter of getting older and realizing how the world works. I just felt like I had to do something. I think a lot of people are getting lied to. And, you know, I hope these guys that are coming back from all of these faraway places are okay when they come back. And I hope that they have the support of the government if they're not okay.
And if they're asked to stay abroad and occupy a nation, nations for long periods of time, what does that mean for the role of the U.S. military? Are we creating a kind of French Foreign Legion here? And is that right?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be very hard on them. And it's certainly going to be very hard on their families. After coming back from the first Gulf War, I realized that the whole experience was probably harder on my family. You know, at least being over there, I could assess risks at any given moment and relax if that was appropriate. They really didn't have the opportunity to do that, so they kind of had to wring their hands the whole time. So, I mean, if you've got a son or daughter over there in Afghanistan for an extended period of time, you just never know what's going to happen.
Brian Murphy, in your mind, what's the best way for Americans then, with all these complexities, to observe publicly or privately Memorial Day that would be meaningful, that would be correct to you?
I think it's about an idea, and I think sacrifices in some circumstances is necessary, but these sacrifices should be made for the right reasons. And I think we should honor the people who make these sacrifices, but we should make sacrifices when necessary.
And what does that mean about the moment we're at right now?
I think people need to ask some serious questions. What are we as a nation? You know, what is the military for?
So mark you up as a vet who's feeling skepticism in this Memorial Day season.
Yes.
Brian Murphy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Murphy served with the 124th Intelligence Battalion in the 1st Gulf War. He spoke with us from Boston. Jack Beatty there is a soldier, a veteran, who's focused on the absurdity of war up against the marching bands today.
Yes, and he contrasted the two wars, Gulf War I and II. Gulf War I, 148 U.S. killed, 460 wounded. Gulf War II, as of yesterday, 64 killed, over 500 wounded. And now we read in the Christian Science Monitor that evidence is mounting to suggest that between 5,000 and 10,000 Iraqi civilians may have died.
I can't help thinking through all these interviews, Jack, of how the meaning of Memorial Day may actually change, may be changing with a new foreign policy. I mean, the backdrop to all of this is the historical image of Americans as citizen soldiers to go off to war, to come back, to stand down. Now we've got something different, more professional, longer-term deployments, no apologies.
Yeah, and again, I mean, critics of the professional military argue that it's too easy to deploy them, too easy to use them when they are not connected to the citizenry, when they are a professional armed force. Our founding fathers warned against what they called a standing army, that is, one that standed even after war was over, that was left standing. And, of course, even Memorial Day, it used to feel like a national holiday. Everybody seemed to have a cousin or brother or involved somehow, but now that circle of participation is narrowing in America. And as I was looking today at the places from which the dead U.S. soldiers came, Sparks, Nevada, Neptune, Montana, you know, Pea Ridge, someplace else, rural, small-town America, for the most part, and not exactly centers of what one could call the fat of the land.
And nothing like the numbers of dead that previous wars produced, and we are thankful for that, but yet it makes a different dynamic. Jack, stand by. We've got another piece of tape here I want to share. It's a long, difficult wait for families with loved ones serving in the military. Wendy Pettit knows all about that wait and worry. Her son, Jeremy, is a specialist in the U.S. Army serving with the 101st Airborne in Iraq. She started a group called MilitaryMoms.net. We asked her why she started it up.
I started MilitaryMoms.net when my son left for basic training. I had actually gone on the internet and I was searching around looking for some type of support site, and there really wasn't anything there. So I started the site, and then 9/11 hit, and then we just expanded. We started out with 10 or 12 moms, and we now have over 3,000 registered members. Military Moms is a support site for all branches of the military. We have a message board. We have chat rooms. We do care packages. Actually, yesterday we did a care package mail out, and our total bill at the post office was over $1,500. We do represent each state. The moms will get on the board and they'll post, are there any moms in, let's say, Nebraska or something like that? Would you like to get together for lunch? And the moms will post back on the message board. They'll plan a place where they're going to meet. And several travel from state to state to meet the moms that they have been corresponding with. And the luncheons are just wonderful. It's great to finally meet the person that you've been in contact with. And you try to connect with people that might have, you know, a mom or a wife that might have someone that your son or daughter was in boot camp, or your son or daughter is serving overseas with somebody or unit or base or something like that. And you can say, hey, I got a letter today, or hey, I got a phone call, and have you heard anything? It's great to share that information. It's so great because you kind of graduate. First, you'll start out as a boot camp mom if you do log on to MilitaryMoms.net if your son or daughter just left for the service, and you can get that support, and you can ask questions, and somebody will tell you what to expect for boot camp, and, you know, we meet each other at graduation, and then we move right through the deployment, clear on into the retirement part, because there's always somebody that has a little bit farther than you are that can always share their experience and let you know. I would say the biggest thing that a lot of us express is fear and concern for our loved ones serving, when we're going to hear from them, how will they be when they return from their deployment. It's kind of a scary thing, especially the first deployment, because you really don't know what to expect, and it's great to know that you can ask somebody, you know, As a mother of a son serving in Iraq right now, the news can be very frightening. Sometimes I try to stay away from the news, and then there's sometimes I can't get enough of the news. The support on MilitaryMoms.net is just awesome. You can actually jump on there, or you can call somebody and just say, you know, I'm feeling really down today. Lift me up. You know, get these ugly thoughts out of my head. Make me think good thoughts. Sometimes you can really get yourself so bogged down with worry that you really do need somebody that feels the same way you do. Because I always tell people that if you don't have someone serving in the military, it's really hard to understand, because we're actually really our own little community. Because when our sons and daughters join the military, we pretty much enlisted with them. It's a 24-hour day job, 7 days a week. For the average person, they can flip off the TV and say, oh, I'm just so sick and tired of hearing all this stuff about the war or this or that. It does not go away from us. During the pre-campaign for the war, and when all the deployments were going on, when you'd see all the families standing there crying and hugging their loved one leaving, that's kind of where Military Mom steps in. Because when the camera pans away, when you see those things on the news, our tears don't dry up, and it doesn't go away, because it's nonstop, because our loved one has gone. The public may have forgotten about us, but our faces behind that camera, when the camera's gone, we still have the tears. We're still in worry. We're still in pain, and we're waiting for the day when our loved one comes back home. We have one member in our group who actually lost her son in Afghanistan last year in June. We all stepped in as a group here in Western New York, and we helped with the funeral, with the food and the support and this and that, and we've been holding her hand. She still has really tough days, but it's just so awesome that she is still very actively involved in MilitaryMoms.net. She still comes to our care packing. She still comes to our luncheons. She's a very proud mom, very, very proud. She's very proud of her son. She's a very strong woman. One of the things she always tells us is, you can do it if something happened, because you have to. Memorial Day has definitely changed a lot since my son enlisted in the military. I think for the most part, the majority of someone that doesn't have someone serving, it's kind of that parade and picnic day, but pulls at your heartstrings, because it really makes you worry about your son or your daughter. It's very emotional. I'm constantly just praying for his safety and his safe return, you know, all of our troops' safety and safe return.
Wendy Pettit is founder of MilitaryMoms.net, an online support group for mothers with children serving in the armed forces. Her son, Jeremy, is an Army specialist in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. Jack Beatty, maybe this is the heart of it. Mothers managing fear, real mothers with real sons and daughters in the realm of war.
Yes, and boy, do they serve in a war. I mean, their emotions, their worries. My nephew is still over there now, and I just heard that his job is collecting unspent munitions. And, of course, what his mother must think about that.
The war is not over for him or her. Jack, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Jack Beatty and a special Memorial Day edition of On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook with a special Memorial Day edition of On Point. Military chaplains have brought moral support and guidance to all American battlefronts and now to forces in Iraq. Fred Hudson is senior chaplain at Fort Bliss, Texas. The base made front page headlines when members of its 507th maintenance company were ambushed in Iraq on March 23rd. 9 soldiers were killed and 8 taken hostage, among them Private Jessica Lynch. Chaplain Hudson conducted the memorial service for the 9 slain soldiers. We spoke with him about what message he wanted to convey to the families of those who have lost loved ones in the war in Iraq, and what he planned to say in observance of this Memorial Day.
We scheduled our memorial ceremony for our 9 soldiers, and the message that I delivered was one that I gave a great deal of thought to, and it was intended to honor soldiers as being high-profile individuals, people who are obviously volunteers, but as we recognize, they are literally in something more than just a volunteer. They are in an ordained calling. A soldier is somebody who, we know from the Word of God, does not bear the sword in vain. And we had 9 soldiers who were killed, and we honored them specifically as soldiers. In the words of those who rescued Jessica Lynch, they first said to her, you know, we are United States soldiers, and we are here to protect you and to take you home. And I concluded that message by saying to these nine soldiers, as I looked at their helmets and dog tags and pictures with Purple Hearts draped over them, that we are American soldiers too, and we are here to take you home. Following that, the roll call, where each soldier's name was called out, and then the playing of taps and the bagpipes playing Amazing Grace as they walked out of the facility. I've been at Fort Bliss for about 9 months, arrived here in August to sign as the installation chaplain. And of course, shortly thereafter, we started deploying soldiers. And anytime you deploy soldiers, it's always a dangerous time, but especially in light of a possibility of war with Iraq. It was difficult for everybody to see soldiers board a plane and fly out with the realization we weren't sure when they would be coming back and what they would be facing when they got there. The issue that soldiers might surface, what about the right or wrong of killing someone? And depending on a person's faith background, coming from my tradition, which is a general Protestant background, we would share with soldiers that there's a difference between murder and a soldier being killed or taking another life in combat. The Word of God says that in Romans 13, that a soldier does not bear the sword in vain. And obviously in the first century, a sword is only used for one thing, and that was for taking life. And therefore, we're told in the Word of the Lord that a soldier's calling is just that, a calling. And it's a calling to use the sword. And the intent of that is to defend his country in a very noble and just manner, in a noble cause. And that will involve, in times, taking another life to save lives. And so the fact boils down, bottom line, to this, that peace is established by war. Soldiers trained for war to establish peace. So there is a time and a need where just nations need to rise up to protect and defend those who cannot protect and defend themselves. As a chaplain in the Army, we are here to serve those who serve our country. And there's never been a question in my mind over the last 6 months, a year, number one, the just cause of a soldier, what's involved in being a soldier, bottom line up front, the whole purpose of the Army is to be prepared to go to war, to defeat, quote, and or destroy the enemy, to protect our country. And as a chaplain, I'm here to serve those who serve our country, who have to do that. We are not combatants as chaplains, but we accompany combatants wherever they go. And if that's back here at Fort Bliss, or if that's in the line of fire on the battlefield, our role is to be there with soldiers to care for the living, to honor the dead, to support them in their faith during that time of conflict. We will be remembering our soldiers on Monday at the Fort Bliss National Cemetery. And we will remember all soldiers that are buried here and throughout our nation, as will be conducted all military installation in many other places. And the purpose of that is to remember them and to say that we will not allow them to be forgotten, that they have paid the ultimate sacrifice. For those who possibly are still living, who lost a loved one, it is certainly a comfort to them to know that their loved one is remembered. And our soldiers have participated in Operation Enduring Freedom and Free Iraq in a very noble, just cause. As those who lost loved ones, whether it's Vietnam, Korea, World War II, World War I, or whatever. And Memorial Day is a time that we gather together to remember them and to comfort the loved ones who are there through remembering our soldiers, and to say to soldiers in the future that they will be remembered if they fall in combat.
Fred Hudson is senior chaplain at Fort Bliss, Texas.
Jack Beatty, I'm struck throughout this hour by the range of views among American soldiers and veterans. This chaplain, we hear about the absurdity of war, the nobility of war, the sacred, the profane. It's all there.
Yes, and I just couldn't, the obvious irony, Fort Bliss with 9 dead of all names. You know, the chaplain made an interesting point. He said that peace is established by war. And I see that, but it's also the case that war is established by war. World War I clearly established World War II, made it practically inevitable given the peace and the shape of the peace treaty after that war. Gulf War I clearly made way, lit the fuse to Gulf War II, not because Saddam was allowed to stay in power, but because we based forces in Saudi Arabia that created the whole dynamic of terrorism and which led us back into the Gulf again. So it seems as if wars are contagious almost, and that maybe peace, if it could just grow for an interval without wars, could build up a momentum all by itself that would make it seem irreplaceable, something no one wanted to violate other than absolutely crucial national emergencies.
You can feel on this day and in all these voices how important it is to have the policy right, because throughout the Gulf War you could feel Americans wanting to support those troops individually, one by one, yearning to wish them well. We've got to have the goals right.
Yes, and you know, that's a kind of patriotism, and the example of it was set by Abraham Lincoln in the Mexican War. He was a Whig congressman. He was against the war. He attacked the Polk administration for lying about the origins of the war, and at the same time, he spoke up with sympathy for the veterans, for the people who had to conduct a policy that he saw and said was wrong.
Our respect to American soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women today. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with me this hour.
Thank you.
Coming up, reviving the tradition of the service star. This is On Point. The service flag is a tradition that dates back to World War I, a blue star on a white backdrop with a red border signifying a loved one serving in the military. Traditionally, the service flag was made by a family member and displayed in wartime. And if a loved one died in battle, a gold star would be stitched on top of the blue star to signify that sacrifice. The service flag went out of fashion during the Korean War, Vietnam, and the First Gulf War. But over the last few months, members of the Aberdeen Proving Ground Military and Civilian Spouses Club in Aberdeen, Maryland, have revived the tradition with Operation Gold Star Flag, which now, again, makes service flags for families of those who have served and those who have died. In this radio diary, we spoke with Operation Gold Star Flag founder Elaine Valentin and Gold Star volunteers Angie Salami and Beth Russell.
My name is Elaine Valentin. I'm a military wife, and I had founded Operation Gold Star Flag. My husband is Army in the Ordnance Corps, and my grandfather was Army, and my other grandfather was Navy. I originally wanted to find a flag, actually, to purchase for my grandmother in honor of my grandfather, who had served in World War II. And I could not find any service flags that were made anywhere and decided to just make one for my grandmother and received permission from the Pentagon to do it. And in that process, decided that the Gold Star flag meant a lot. Melanie Gallinger is a co-member of the Aberdeen Proving Ground Military and Civilian Spouses Club. She had contacted me and asked if I needed some help as the casualties started mounting. Of course, I accepted immediately, and she contacted the other ladies in the group. They were wholeheartedly behind us, got together, brought their sewing machines, their irons, their ironing boards, scissors, cutting mats, everything possible, and got together at the chapel, and we've done it on two occasions to get together and to sew the red strips around to the white to make the border, and then they hand them off to me to do the embroidery.
I am Beth Roussel. My husband is currently deployed to Iraq. We were astonished by the number of people who showed up just with scissors in hand and a ruler in the other hand, just, what can I do? How can I help? And then they took that experience of the first day that we were all together working, and it was very moving just to see ladies lined up down the hallways ironing yards and yards of red fabric. I mean, it was everywhere. There was fabric everywhere. There were people everywhere. They had those little ironing boards that you shove under a bed when you're in college, and they had the big ironing boards, and they had just, you know, anywhere they could find a plug, they were plugged in and pressing out this fabric, and that was an amazing sight.
The environment of what we have when we do get together, I hate to say that there's a happy attitude. It's more of the fact that we enjoy each other's company. We know the camaraderie. We are a very, very close-knit group. And it is a chance for us to get together and talk about what it means to be in the military community and what it means to be that close-knit family. But when it does get silent, and it really does get very, very eerily silent, and all you hear is the hum of the machine, and you do notice that there are some tears that fall, because as some of these ladies are sewing, many of them will tell you that they are thinking about the list of names of those who have lost their lives or have given their lives for our country. And whether it be Captain Chris Seifert, who lost his life in a grenade attack, or it could be someone who lost their life as a POW, they think about what he might have endured. They think about what it would mean to have their husband or their wife in that position. It's one of those things that is profoundly silent.
My name is Angela Salami. My husband is currently deployed to Camp Doha, Kuwait. My Blue Star flag hangs in my front dining room window, which faces out to the street that everybody drives by. And I see it all the time because it's right in the most prominent room in my house. And it is hanging there. There's no embroidery on it yet. I just wanted the plain, traditional Blue Star flag to hang there. And I really like it a lot because I feel connected to the mothers and wives from World War II when these first started. And although I didn't sew this myself, I know the girl that sewed it for me, and on the back it says, handmade for you by a military wife, which really could be anybody. And when she told me when she passes this business along, when, you know, 80 years from now, it will just be a military wife who sewed that flag. And that's what makes it really cool and kind of the legacy with it that just will continue on and on.
I think we have a more personal connection this year to each of the soldiers and to the general idea that easily there could be more casualties, there could have been more casualties, and there will always be casualties. This is a mission that we will forever be doing in wartime and in peace. And I think as we sew these flags and we get them to the families, as many as we can before Memorial Day, for them to display on Memorial Day, I think we just have that very significant connection. We feel like we have personally known each of these soldiers.
Operation Gold Star Flag founder Elaine Valentin and Gold Star volunteers Angie Salami and Beth Russell. They spoke with us from their homes at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. For more information about Operation Gold Star Flag or militarymoms.net, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR, refunded by you are listening.